I wanted to introduce our artist today, Sam Durant. He's a multimedia artist whose work has been exhibited widely and internationally. He's born in Massachusetts and lives and works in Los Angeles, California. He's been awarded a Smithsonian Research Fellowship this year, and he's currently exploring the San Blas, San Blas Cuna Indians of Panama. And these Indians have been represented in the Smithsonian. So we're going to focus today mainly on three bodies of work that are most recent, and also talk a little bit about the research he's been doing.
I've done a number of different projects dealing with monuments, and this is a found photograph of a monument that was done to Chief Ore, who was important diplomatic leader in Oklahoma at the turn of the century, between to organize the various bands of Native Americans that were relocating into Oklahoma, and the good folks of Oklahoma City decided to make a monument to Chief Ore. And this is at the unveiling of this monument. This is probably 1905, something like that. I think it's just kind of says it all in terms of Native American and white immigrant relations. Anyway, this is a project called a proposal for white and Indian dead monuments transposition. So it's a kind of theoretical proposal that would, in theory, take place here on the National Mall. These are monuments scaled down, kind of maquette versions of monuments from all over the country that are dedicated either to whites or Indians that were killed during the conquest of what eventually became North America. So this group here that you see in this big room are all monuments that are dedicated to white settlers that were killed by Indians during skirmishes and battles and wars and things like that. There's a very strict criteria for these. For instance, I didn't include monuments that were for dedicated to soldiers or military things. It was more about the kind of collateral damage that happened. How white settlers were used in a lot of cases to take over territory and to fight kind of proxy wars. In that sense. So,
could you talk about the scale just a little bit? Why some are smaller than others, or?
Well, they're all scaled using the identical formula. So I think it's like 3 to 1 or something. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a range. The other criteria is that they're non-figurative and that they take a kind of a vertically oriented form, so that they would relate to the Washington Monument here, the father of all vertically oriented forms. And in this room you see five monuments. These are the ones dedicated to Indians. So you get a kind of, you get the disparity, the kind of a visual representation of the disparity between the numbers. And then here's the plan of how it would work. So theoretically, all these monuments would be dug up from where they are around the country and then reinstalled along the reflecting pool. So these would be the monuments to the whites here, Lincoln Memorial, obviously. And then in front of the Washington Monument, you would have the ones to Native Americans.
Yeah, there seems to be kind of a difference in numbers.
Yeah. This is the architectural model that we did, so you can kind of, it's a little hard to tell what you can see here. And these are just some of the different individual. At Bloody Brook in Massachusetts. That's the actual monument. This was King Philip's War, a very early, you know, really at the beginning of the. This was in the 17th century, so quite early.
And what are these made out of?
The like particle board and. Some of them have foam, carving foam on them. Mm-hmm. This is the Custer battlefield, the Battle of Bighorn, where General Custer was killed. This is a Wounded Knee monument in Kansas. This is the Wounded Knee monument that's actually on the site at Wounded Knee. This is the one to the Indians that were killed there at that massacre. And this one, I mean, this is really the conclusion of the Indian Wars. It was 1893, and after that, there really wasn't. It was sort of isolated skirmishes and things, but mm-hmm. That was really the conclusion of it. Mm-hmm. These are two monuments in Minnesota. One is to whites killed during the Dakota Uprising, 1840s, and the other one is to friendly Indians who were helping the white settlers. Gnadenhütten is in Ohio. This one's kind of awful and interesting. It was the first, apparently the first, what do you call it when you kill non-combatants in a war?
Civilians.
No. Collective, I don't know, I can't think of what it is. Anyway, they, collateral, yeah, there's another term, I can't think of it right now, I'm blanking. Anyway. There was a militia that was heading back home from fighting in Black Hawk's War, which was in Illinois, and they'd really been, you know, Black Hawk's forces had been really kind of dominating, taking out a lot of casualties on this group, and on their way back home, they found a village in Ohio that had a kind of Christianized group of Indians there that were very. Were living in houses and farming, and were kind of domesticated, as it were, westernized, whatever you want to say, and they killed the entire village as a kind of retribution. Mm. Yeah, it's a kind of an awful story.
And so the monument is.
The monument here, yeah.
It's related.
Yeah,
to
it's actually in commemorating the Indians that were killed. So
it's kind of a celebration.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it, it tells...
Why do you build a monument to that, I guess is what I'm trying to understand. But
it's interesting because it's like, remember, you know, it's like the Holocaust Memorial or something,
right.
Where you actually, the perpetrators have to remember this.
Oh.
It's so awful.
Oh, I see.
You know,
yeah.
So it's, I think in this case,
yeah.
Kind of interesting. Unusual, yeah. This project is I did in Massachusetts in Boston at the Massachusetts College of Art, where I went to school as an undergraduate back in the early 1980s. They invited me back to do a project there. I did a series of works that I call the Pilgrim story, and I grew up in Massachusetts, not far from the Plymouth Rock, actually, and so I was really indoctrinated into the story of the Pilgrims, and we would, as a school kid, we would go to we would go to Plymouth and look at the rock, and there was a wax museum there. We would go to this wax museum, and that's how we sort of learned early American history. And when I went back to do this project, I thought maybe I would do something a little site-specific and a little bit autobiographical. So when I was researching this for this project, the wax museum that's down there by the Plymouth Rock was going out of business, and so they were nice enough to sell me a number of the figures and exhibits and stuff. And this project, you can see, is basically a turntable, like, you know, when they put a car on there and it spins around really slowly. This has two scenes from the wax museum, one on each side, and it slowly kind of spins around. And this scene is a big part of the pilgrim mythology, where Squanto teaches the pilgrims, the English settlers, how to fertilize their corn by putting a fish in with the seed. And this, you know, enables the colonists to have a good harvest, and which leads to Thanksgiving and so forth and so on. So it's a kind of very, those of you that don't know the story, it's a very iconic part of it. Also feeds into this kind of this contradiction where the Indians were both friendly and hostile, and they were there and not there. So the other side. Well, this is. Sorry,
I have a question about them. Did you have to alter them in any sort of way when you made them into artwork, or did you just use them as found? I mean, in terms of the what you did to them.
Well, we had to get the right figures, and we had to make props and clothes, and you know, we used this. This is a postcard.
Okay.
Image. So we just used this image to construct that diorama, and then on the other side, I found this postcard in the basement of the museum. And this exhibit was not in the wax museum. It was taken out in very early on. I think for obvious reasons, it sort of demonstrates the. I mean, here's Miles Standish killing an Indian, so that had to be taken out. You could see the bloody knife. So this is
it's in his chest, right?
Yeah, he's been stabbed. So we reconstructed that scene on the other side, and this is an interesting one because the Indian that's being killed here by Miles Standish is a Pequot Indian, and there were a number of different bands in New England when the Pilgrims arrived, and the Pequots were not friendly. They were resisting as the colony was expanding and taking over land and using hunting grounds and so forth. The Pequots were resisting, violently resisting, and at a certain point the colony decided that they had to put a stop to it, and they organized a militia and wiped out the entire population in one night in this enormous bloodbath. And in Miles Standish's memoirs, he describes the massacre in very graphic detail.
He doesn't, when he writes about it, he doesn't try to cover up. I mean, you'd think he would want to.
No, I mean, I think that's
at the time.
This is 16.
Yeah, that's right. You forget yeah. It was their right.
It was a brutal time.
Right.
And it was about survival. So when the militia party returned to the colony, they after the successful massacre, they had a Thanksgiving celebration.
Yeah.
And many people argue that that's actually the foundation for our present day Thanksgiving.
So this piece is about Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it took place, it opened like the week before Thanksgiving, I think, so.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't say that, it was in the materials. There's some more images.
Okay.
I didn't make that explicit in the work itself.
Was there sound related to it at all, or was it
No.
Because I know some of your work uses sound.
Yeah, no, yeah. This didn't have any sound. This work is more of a kind of about the positioning of the various monuments on the site in Plymouth. You see a kind of a Hollywood prop version of the Plymouth Rock and this sort of Museum of Natural History style kind of didactic sign. This has a text on it that comes from an actual plaque in Plymouth. This is the plaque in Plymouth, which is about King Philip's War. Metacomet was the son of Massasoit and led the Algonquin Confederacy in a war against the expanding colonies, Plymouth Colony and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and nearly won the war. But he was killed, he was ambushed and killed. And the first monument in Plymouth was actually Metacomet's head on the end of a pole that was stuck in the town square for, they say, 20 years. I don't know if the head lasts 20 years. I can't believe that. But anyway.
In the text, how do they talk about this?
If you want to read it.
Okay.
Can you read that? Yeah.
After the pilgrims' arrival, Native Americans in New England grew increasingly frustrated with the English settlers' abuse and treachery. Metacomet, a son of the Wampanoag, I can't read that one.
Sachem.
Yeah, Sachem, known as the
Massasoit,
called upon all Native people to unite to defend their homeland against encroachment. His head was impaled on a pike and was displayed near the site for more than 20 years. One hand was sent to Boston, the other to England. His wife and son, along with the families of many of the Native Americans combatants, were sold into slavery in the West Indies by the English victors. And it just says, United American Indians of New England.
Yeah, this was put up in the 70s by United American Indians of New England, which are trying to sort of counter the sort of propaganda or one-sidedness of the existing monuments. This is a bronze statue of Massasoit, who was the Wampanoag leader at the time that the pilgrims arrived. A little kind of side note, this sculpture was made by an artist named Cyrus Dallin. And Cyrus Dallin actually was one of the first sculpture teachers at Mass College of Art. Mm-hmm. And so in some senses there's a little bit, in my project, a little bit of a nod to that that history as well. There it is, the Plymouth Rock. Apparently America's most underwhelming monument.
How big is that? I mean, this slide is probably bigger than it actually is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's probably about that big, yeah. But you know, it's in this enormous portico, and you think that's this big thing, and you get there and you look down, and there's this rock down there. I don't know if they chiseled that in as soon as they landed on it, you know. That's where it all started, you know.
It looks worn on the side too.
They glued it back. It broke apart and they glued it back together. You can see the cement glue that they glued right here.
It seems like part. I mean, you can disagree, please, but isn't it part of your work is that the wear and tear of the objects is part of it? That you like the part that like for instance with the dummies, the, well, I call them the dummies, but the figures that you used in the Plymouth Rock, in the Pilgrim series, they also seemed, you know, the wigs looked a little kind of ratty.
Ratty, yeah.
I guess I noticed that first, but I mean, they also just, there's a little wear and tear, so it's, can you talk a little bit more about why you keep that or why you wouldn't want, what attracts you to that?
I mean, yeah, it wasn't so much that I was attracted to it, it's just what we had, you know, and I think...
There's not a sense of wanting to clean things up?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, okay. It was meant to refer to that exactly what it was, which was, you know, the wax museum. Upstairs there was a sort of balcony area where there was a number of didactic panels and then quite a lot of research materials and things like that. If anybody was interested in getting more information and background on the history and also on the work.
And that's interesting, so that's part of the installation.
And that travels with the project, so it all gets, you know, shown together. There was a video as well. I'm not going to bore you with the video, but there's a wall text, if you can see faintly in this image, the wall text that goes next to the entryway to the theater. And this is a key document here, a key passage. It's from a book called Mort's Relation, which is a kind of compilation of first-hand accounts that the settlers in Plymouth wrote. And this section here is, I don't know why I need this pointer. This section here...
it's kind of fun to do.
Yeah, it is written by a guy named Robert Cushman, who was the sort of main organizer of the Mayflower voyage. He was the financier for the expedition, put together the financing for it and got the boat and so forth. And it's basically, he was a lawyer, it's the legal argument for taking possession of the land and extinguishing native title to any piece of territory. So it's a kind of legal moral document, in a sense, that outlines the different kinds of reasons why the English settlers could take possession. Which I think is, you know, in terms of getting to this idea of manifest destiny and stuff, the later conquest of the western half of the country, this is the beginnings of it. And it's also, I mean, there's so many interesting things that are kind of hidden away in the Pilgrim story, and another one is the kind of establishment of a capitalistic system, economic system, in the New World. And there was a number of documents that were drawn up during the voyage to reestablish that situation of the indentured servants, that they, once they got to the territory, that they would stay indentured, that they wouldn't be forgiven their debt and so forth. Yeah, and you know, that's interesting.
So, what I've been thinking about is that your installations almost travel with their own education department. Like that, it's an interesting thing because you are operating in some ways as an institution within institutions. No, like you're a traveling institution. You don't really think about it that way, I'm sure.
Andrea Fraser made that argument that we're all institutions and there's no outside, and the question is just what kind of institution do you want? Uh-huh. So, fine.
And would you say that maybe, we'll get back to these too, but would you say that you're interested in creating kind of alternatives to history, or?
Well, yeah, I'm interested in exploring history and exploring aspects of it that are lesser known, or just different sides, offering a different perspective on history that we think we, or that we, you know, we know certain aspects of it.
So it seems like it's definitely needs to have a gallery. It definitely needs to be in institutions in a way.
Well, there is a lot of information in the work. It's true. Yeah. The work itself is obviously has, it's playful. There's humor in a lot of it, and it's, some of it is more visually interesting than others. But I also don't want to overwhelm the viewer with too much information. So often the information side is kind of separated. So If somebody doesn't want to spend the time, they're not interested, fine, they don't have to deal with it. There's other things that they can enjoy in the work. So it's a somewhat of a compromise, I think, which, you know, differs project to project, I guess. This is a thing that I'm in the middle of now, is dealing with the history of the death penalty. And probably some of you remember the Pew report on the status of the prison system in the U.S. came out a couple of months ago with some pretty, you know, shocking figures. That we have the most prisoners in the world, and 1 in 9 black men is in prison, things like that. And of course, we're the only sort of Western democracy that still uses the death penalty. Anyway, I did a series of these architectural models of historically significant or important gallows. Here you have John Brown, who probably everyone knows John Brown, the abolitionist who was hung down in, you know, for his uprising down in Harper's Ferry. The one in the center is the Lincoln conspirators, the four conspirators in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Interestingly, one of whom was a woman. She was the first woman that was executed by the U.S. Government, federal government. And the other one is Billy Bailey, who was the last person to be hanged. It was in 1995 in Delaware. So they're, come to think of it, they're all kind of local.
Can we talk a little bit about how the mirrors operate for you?
Well, it's a kind of display device in this case that does a couple things. One, it allows you to see the object, inversion of the object, and it in symbolic terms, I think maybe it signals to the viewer that this is a kind of reflective, a kind of intellectually reflective idea going on in the work here.
I mean, I haven't experienced this personally, but it seems to me that you'd also see yourself reflected in there.
Yeah, you do. Exactly.
And there's a sense that anyone can be hung.
Yeah.
You know, anyone can be part of this lovely experience, you know. And then on the walls?
These are a series of drawings which actually combine images, like little vignette images of contemporary, these are all historical with the exception of that one, which is the gallows that Saddam Hussein was hung on. The other ones are, so the idea was to make this kind of continuum, historical continuum, coming up to the present. And then in the drawings, it's sort of a combination of an image and then information on the drawing. So the images up here are contemporary things from what we use now, which is lethal injection.
Right.
So they're different death chambers and different little things that are in around the death chamber in a couple of different prisons. And then the information is presented down here. It's just all kinds of it's all kinds of different things, like increases in African American male population. That's prison and that's higher education.
Yeah, that's that. I remember that statistic coming out that there were more African Americans in prison than in higher education.
Another kind of thing that I often do is to put text and things in reverse or upside down and stuff to kind of...
What's that about?
Challenge or destabilize the kind of, you know, I mean, you're getting this information, like, this is very authoritative, right? The pie chart or the graph, it's just kind of, you know... Mm. So I wanted to kind of like also challenge that authority a little bit.
It's interesting because it's a contrast. The display is very neutral. The way you're approaching the drawing has almost like information.
Yeah.
The way that I see you, there's no expressive qualities. It's just all very neutral. So when you do that, it kind of says, it draws people in, that this is factual and this is going to be stabilizing you, but then it destabilizes them. It makes them distrust it a little bit, yeah, maybe by switching it around.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So most of this information is about, you know, the many different arguments as to why the death penalty is not necessary, is ineffectual, doesn't make us safer, all the reasons, you know. The number of innocent people that wind up on death row, the racial disparities, education, you know, all that kind of information. The eventual result, I mean, I'm working through all these different models and kind of trying out different ideas, but hopefully the result is going to be this enormous compilation of all the gallows built together, so to scale. So you would have this one. You can see, I think there's four or five different ones, and then the platforms are just layered up on top of each other like this, with the most recent being the bottom level, which is the Saddam Hussein gallows here on the bottom, and then it would go through the you know, years up, and then they're just centered over the positioning is they're just centered over the hole where you drop through to get hung on.
Kind of like a mandala or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the idea is that you would be able to climb, go up on this and walk around and, you know.
Oh, so this is a proposal for something people physically could walk around in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll happen, get started this summer building that. And then I thought I'd just talk for a minute or two about the project here at the Smithsonian. And you mentioned the Kuna Indians in Panama. So I'm kind of interested in the relationship between the Kuna, the Panamanian state, and the U.S. I mean, as we know, the U.S. has been intimately involved in Panama for a long time. This is an image of a traditional art form that the Kuna women primarily make. It's called a mola. Probably some of you have seen molas. But in addition to sort of more culturally based designs and things, they also use a lot of imagery that they find, from all kinds of sources. This one's interesting because for me, it has the Panama flag and the U.S. flag together here. You got the canal. This is the region where the Kuna live, and their nation is called Kunayala, and actually they're the only indigenous group that has autonomous territory in the Americas. They actually are sovereign. They have a sovereign nation up here on the islands and along the coast right here. So that kind of interested me too, having done a number of different projects dealing with kind of white indigenous relationships and history. So, there we go. This is one of the Kuna women they organized a collective and they make and sell these the molas as a kind of, you know, economic development tool. And they have a very, I mean, it's quite an interesting relationship to both the U.S. and to Panama in terms of maintaining this state of autonomy or sovereignty. But they do engage in certain ways with the outside world. And the kind of the key figure for me in terms of getting into this project was a guy named Richard Marsh, who you see here in a sort of classic colonial position with a young Kuna boy. He was a diplomatic attaché to Panama, right as the state was being, or just after it had become a nation, it separated from Colombia and become a nation. He was down there, and he heard about these white Indians, and so he became obsessed with finding the white Indians in the Darien Peninsula. And he did find them. Here you see an image from one of his expeditions. Of course, they're albino.
Yeah,
but he
that
was.
So why was that? Does it say why it was important for him to find these or these people? Or?
You know, it was profoundly racist.
Yeah.
And I think part of it, and the race relations in Panama are very complicated as well, because you had in the Canal Zone, of course, during Jim Crow,
right.
The Canal Zone was exactly like the U.S. It was racially segregated. So you had whites and colored,
uh-huh.
blah blah blah. You know, so there was a real macrocosm. And but the Kuna, particularly the Kuna, were thought of as somehow above. They were almost white in the kind of racial hierarchy in Panama. Even trusted and thought more highly of than Panamanian, mestizo
right.
people. So I think there was this idea that, you know, somehow for him there was this kind of fantasy.
Yeah,
this racial fantasy about indigenous people. And here he brought a number of them back, arranged for a number of them to come back to the U.S. And here's a picture of J.P. Harrington, the ethnologist making recordings here at the Smithsonian in 1924. And they have the recordings actually at the Library of Congress. They made wax disc recordings. Very interesting.
Are they the cylinders or the?
Yeah, the wax cylinders.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I said that. Yeah. this guy here actually got a master's degree from Harvard, and that's another thing that's very contradictory and interesting. The Kunas send a number of their best students off to these great universities like Oxford and Harvard and Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them have PhDs.
Uh-huh.
And then they wind up. Normally, they would go back to and live in the communities. That's very interesting. These are just some more molas. These are from the collection here, in the anthropology archives. I mean, this is they're just some amazing ones. I mean, this one is it's probably from an illustration in a science fiction book that they saw. So. But the thing that I'm interested in is this. So here you have two boxers. Here you've got wrestlers, like Mexican wrestlers.
Right.
And this is maybe something more traditional. The swastika is actually the symbol on the Kuna flag. Of course, that was developed, long before the Nazis' adoption. Of it, another kind of geometric pattern. So, anyway, I don't know. I mean, I guess what I started to say was I'm interested in how the what's going on, particularly in this sort of post It's not a post-colonial anthropology. I don't know what you call it. There's a kind of, you know, Michael Taussig, who's a writer and a kind of performance studies guy, has been very important in thinking about, you have this historical understanding from the West looking at indigenous cultures as somehow mythical, magical,
right.
You know, the opposite of civilization and science and all that. And I think here, like in these kinds of things where you see the kunas appropriating images and meanings from the West and incorporating them, I mean,
right.
in a sense, like doing the same thing that the Western
right.
anthropologists are doing, you know.
Uh-huh.
So this idea that magic and modernity are opposed is
right.
kind of falls apart at that point.
Interesting.
This is the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama. It was started on an island and when they made Gatun Lake, they dammed the lake and made this huge lake. And this was a mountaintop originally, but when they made the canal, it became an island in this lake. And that's where they started. So they have facilities. They actually had a facility in the Kunayala in the late 70s, but the Kuna kicked them out finally,
uh-huh.
as they do to everyone who goes there. So no one's ever been able to sort of stay. So they've maintained this
yeah.
interesting relationship to the outside world.